Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Ty Bannerman. As winter approaches and COVID-19 continues to spread at an alarming rate, politicians will be making decisions that can mean life or death for their constituents. This morning, we want to hear how things are going for you and what you expect from the people you're supporting at the ballot box. Have you had trouble paying your bills or getting health care during the COVID crisis? What do you think New Mexico's politicians should know about your situation? What promises do you want politicians to make good on? Email us at letstalk@kunm.org. Talk to us on Twitter with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM or give us a call at 277-5866. Now, we know that many of you are still weighing candidates and issues while making plans to cast your ballot. So throughout the hour, we'll be bringing you bits of election info that we hope will help you out. News director Hannah Colton kicks us off.
If you still haven't registered to vote or need to update your registration, it's not too late to get in on this election. Here's KUNM's Kaveh Movahed with the details.
Last year, New Mexicans got the option to register and cast a ballot on the same day. To do that, Bernalillo County Clerk Linda Stover said folks will need to bring a photo ID, and if it's not a New Mexico driver's license or state ID, then they'll also need to bring a document that shows their name and current address.
They can bring a utility bill or anything, a rent receipt, something that proves that they live within Bernalillo County.
In Bernalillo County, there are 7 early voting sites that offer same-day registration. In Sandoval County, it's at any early voting location. In Santa Fe County, head to the clerk's office. You can register in person through Saturday, but it's not an option on Election Day itself.
And that was News Director Hannah Colton with some voting information. We will begin today's conversation with Albuquerque's Mayor Tim Keller. Good morning, Mayor Keller. Thank you for joining me today.
Good morning. Great to be with you.
So many Albuquerque residents are experiencing significant hardship due to fallout from COVID, and with no end in sight to the pandemic, what kinds of support with rent, food, or other basics is the city offering as we go into winter?
It's definitely the case that, you know, Corona has shown us all the cracks that we had in our system, and it's made them much, much bigger. We're trying to deal with those cracks in a number of ways. So specific to your question, there is a new program up for rental assistance and also even for mortgage assistance. And you can get up to $1,500 per month for 3 months, but you've got to apply before November 13th. Mm-hmm. So the way to do that is to go to housingnm.org. And that's sort of that's the latest program with the most money available for rental assistance. I would also mention that at any time you can go to one of our 4 health and service centers in Albuquerque. There's one in each quadrant, and they have their own rental assistance fund and emergency food boxes and emergency clothes, especially during the winter. And we've kept those open despite COVID because they're really a place of last resort. And so those are great places for people to go if they need it.
And how can they find some information on where those are?
Sure. One is at John Marshall on Broadway. And first off, you can call 311 or just look at the CABQ website. But they're pretty easy. There's one on Griegos and 4th. There's one John Marshall in South Broadway. There's one in the International District on Pennsylvania or San Pablo and Zuni. And there's one on the west side at Alamosa Community Center.
Now, one of the areas that we've seen a lot of COVID risks is the Metropolitan Detention Center. In fact, we saw a spike in COVID cases there this month. The Daily Lobo reported that dozens of people were jailed in 1 week in October for minor nonviolent offenses. And attorneys and advocates for incarcerated people have been urging police departments to stop making unnecessary arrests. Will you be instructing APD to make those changes to reduce the risk of COVID in jail?
So the situation at the detention center is really obviously run by the county. So the city doesn't have a lot of say on that. And in terms of the actual, you know, what we're arresting folks for and what we're not, it's certainly a concern. And I know we have a general policy, for example, of deterrence and also diversion. So that's what we try and use for all low-level crimes. And I mean, we even decriminalize things like marijuana and so forth. So we do have those in place, but we can't speak to the other law enforcement mm-hmm. departments. And for us to, you know, I believe in strong leadership, but the mayor doesn't actually get to go like tell officers who to arrest and who not to on a one-on-one basis.
Can you explain to me what you mean by diversion?
Sure. We have a series of programs set up where there's alternatives to incarceration. And these are run by an amazing woman named Tanya Covington for our police department. And these are situations where we offer things like a restorative justice alternative, or in many cases, different treatment alternatives, or in some cases, even like healing alternatives if it had to do with, you know, an altercation with someone that they know. And so Tanya's program, the RAD program, is up and running and works on that.
Okay. Now, homelessness was also on the rise in Albuquerque even before the pandemic made many people's housing situation more precarious. But I understand that the city ended the fiscal year with $700,000 worth of housing vouchers undistributed. What happened there?
You know, this was a situation where we contract for those vouchers. In other words, the city gives money to different nonprofits to get those to find housing for folks. And the first thing is that it shouldn't happen. So just straight up, we should have been able to spend that $700,000, and it's something that we're disappointed about for sure. And we have a plan so that it doesn't happen in the future. But it was all because of Corona. Our providers closed down for several months as well, just like everyone else did. And over that time frame, they weren't really able to place people. And so they got backed up, and these are federal dollars. And so they do have tons of paperwork associated with them. And they just couldn't catch up by the deadline for that piece of funding. But going forward, what we're going to be doing is we're setting up actually an umbrella organization that will allow for multiple nonprofits to help hand out these funds. And that's really important because we know it's a good idea. We have the money to do it, but we were just putting too much in like one pipeline and one nonprofit. Mm-hmm. And now we're going to spread that around to small nonprofits and all sorts. And that should start at the beginning of the year. Okay. So it'll be a much better process.
Have you had trouble putting food on the table or paying bills during the pandemic? What do you want to see from your elected leaders as the pandemic wears on? Our phone lines are open. Call 277-5866, or if you're outside the metro area, you can call 1-877-899-5866. And at this point, I'd like to bring into the conversation Khadija Asili Bottom, the director of Visions Sankofa. Welcome to the show, Khadija.
Good morning.
Now, you work with unsheltered individuals in Albuquerque. Among other things, you help them to apply for exactly the kind of housing vouchers that we were just talking about. And I understand that none of the people that you helped apply received aid from the city, even when you helped them get on the list last year. What would you like to say to the mayor about that?
First of all, let me make a correction.
Okay.
When I did the housing survey, it was through New Mexico Coalition to End Homelessness. It wasn't directly with the city. Mm. It's another program that when you do these surveys with people unsheltered, you have to send the information to this department. Mm-hmm. Well, not department, but this organization. And my folks, they said it reached the criteria of being in the top 300.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean
by
that?
Because they had a grading scale.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just because you're homeless don't necessarily make you, you know, you get put in the system, but, you know, you may not ever rise to the top.
Right. Do you have suggestions for how that process could be, like, more streamlined or more effective?
I think, as the mayor said, if they start giving more organization part of the pie.
Mm-hmm. So kind of spread it out like Mayor Keller was saying, find more organizations to get out there and distribute them.
You rely on this one organization, and then they shut down, then everybody just left in the blind.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mayor Keller, have there been other unforeseen effects like what we just talked about with the distribution of the housing vouchers that have affected the way that the city is able to provide services during COVID? I'm sure there must be multiple, but what steps is the city taking to make sure that folks are able to get the things that they need?
Sure, and let me just say too that Khadijah's spot on. I mean, this notion of putting it's like, you know, you don't want to put your eggs in one basket. We had all our voucher eggs in one basket. Mm-hmm. So her organization is a great example of one that in the future we want to make it very, very easy for small nonprofits who are really in touch with the community to be able to get those vouchers out the door. So now there have been numerous other things that have come up. And, you know, one just on the sort of vouchers related issue is, we've also been putting homeless folks in hotels. Mm-hmm. And last week, actually, we filled up an entire hotel, well, the capacity in the hotel that we could use. And now we're opening up a second hotel. And we're having to use voucher money for that. Now, I want to be clear, it's not federal voucher money that, you know, has all these strings attached, but a lot of the flexible money that the city has, we've had to use for hotel vouchers. And sometimes even for emergency workers. So, you know, if they can't go home, they might have a large family and they do test positive. We've been, you know, putting them up in hotels. Mm-hmm. It's been the same with all our essential workers. So that's been just one example of how we've been leveraging a lot of different things to make this work. Another one is our community centers. You know, we have, I think, 22 community centers. And basically, since COVID hit, they are childcare centers for essential workers. And we also, we don't require like paperwork, but if you feel like you have no other option, you know, we'll be able to take care and watch your kids. And that's been something that we've been doing. And it's, at one point we had 10,000 kids in that system. And so this again is, we've totally repurposed what our community centers are for. They're closed to the community. And actually a couple of them we've even used to separate out different housing or homeless populations, mm-hmm. Again, because of the overflow and the spread. So we are trying to transform basically every office we can to prevent people from falling through those cracks, to provide a safety net for Albuquerque.
Now, speaking of sheltering folks, the city reopened the 450-bed West Side shelter after a COVID-19 outbreak forced it to shut down. What sorts of steps will the city be taking to ensure that an outbreak like that one earlier in October doesn't occur again?
Well, we expect outbreaks in all over city facilities in general. And I think that's something that this is about, building resilience. What we want is to keep them as small as possible and to not have to close facilities. So whether it's the solid waste department, you know, or our bus drivers or our homeless shelter, part of being carving our own path and actually keeping that safety net open means like we have to anticipate outbreaks. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the West Side shelter, the studies anticipated probably 600 positive cases, which fortunately we haven't had. Mm-hmm. We did have a large outbreak, but we got some protocols in place. So basically we spread everyone out into a couple of different community centers and into a hotel. And as I mentioned, the biggest change that we made is that outbreak was big enough, we had to actually enroll a second hotel into the program. Mm-hmm. And so we have more space and capacity, but it's a huge concern. I mean, look, in winter, you know, everyone's should be out there if they have nowhere else to stay. And luckily it is a very, very large facility. Mm-hmm. So they're using a heavy pod structure inside the facility.
Right.
And we also have testing out there, by the way. So we were one of the first cities to have testing at a shelter. Mm-hmm. And I hired actually a medical doctor to oversee that. And so that has been one good thing, is we've had testing and screening from really May on. And that's gotten us this far. But obviously that was a really tough outbreak.
I'm Ty Bannerman, and you are listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. This morning, we are talking about the next phase of the pandemic, and we are taking your calls. As Election Day approaches, what kinds of pandemic response do you want to see next? Call us at 277-5866, or you can send us an email with your comments at letstalk@kunm.org. We're going to take a quick break.
Support comes from the State of New Mexico Early Childhood Education and Care Department's Moments Together program, offering parents and caregivers of young children tips for early learning. It isn't hard work, it's play. Details at momentsnm.org.
The Rothstein Donatelli Law Firm is committed to supporting KUNM, where the law firm's criminal practice can help clients petition state courts to permanently remove public records related to criminal charges and certain convictions. Rothsteinlaw.com.
During a year unlike any other in our lifetimes, who will American voters choose to lead our country? Join NPR Tuesday night for special live coverage of Election Night 2020 from NPR News.
That's Tuesday starting at 5 on 89.9 KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. We are taking a hard look this morning at government responses to COVID. How are things going for you, and what do you expect to see from elected leaders at the local, state, or federal level? Call us at 277-5866 and share your thoughts. And a heads up, if you're wondering what to expect in the coming days of this unusual election, this morning at 9, we will carry live online coverage of a pre-election briefing by New Mexico Secretary of State Maggie Toulouse Oliver. You can tune in on the KUNM stream on our website at KUNM.org. And it looks like we have a call, but maybe not ready yet. So I am speaking to Mayor Keller. And Mayor Keller, I wanted to ask you, you know, we have heard from APD and the Family Community Services Department. I'm sorry, we have heard that APD and the Family Community Services Department are still forcing unsheltered people to break up their encampments, often removing and throwing away people's belongings. Given that we're going into a very harsh time of the year, will you be changing the way that the city handles that kind of situations?
Well, what we do is we really try and encourage people to get out to the shelters and anywhere of their choice. And it's because, again, we have medical services out there. We now have even limited, we wish we had more, but even limited treatment services out there. And the biggest thing is now with the temperatures, you know, we're just always really concerned, obviously, about people freezing. And so, you know, in the winter, and it is always, you know, a situation where we want people to be warm and safe. And wonderfully now we even can get them a meal. I mean, it wasn't even until this year we couldn't even get them a meal out there. So that's different than a lot of other cities, for example. So a lot of other cities, obviously, that are warmer, like, you know, it's a different situation. And so we're just very concerned about them freezing.
Certainly. And we have heard some reports of APD often removing and throwing away people's belongings. And as you say, during a time when people could die if they don't have the right gear, will the city maybe halt that practice of taking people's belongings and throwing them away?
So there's been a lot of research and regulation on belongings, and so they should not be taking away people's belongings. The only thing that they do under the city ordinance is camping and overnight sleeping. So, you know, I'm sure on an individual basis, we'd have to go into what specific case folks are referring to, but there are multiple court cases in which case the city has always lost that says you can't confiscate people's belongings. But there also has been held up the city ordinance that camping isn't allowed or overnight sleeping in the city.
Okay. Now, Khadija, going back to you and your organization of Visions Sankofa, of course, you work a lot with the homeless population. What sort of needs are you hearing people express that you work with during this time of increasing COVID? What sort of needs are you hearing from people?
Well, some of the problems is I understand the mayor, you know, saying, okay, we have this West Side shelter, we'd like for you to come there. But as you was talking about their belongings, you know, some people have 2 and 3 shopping carts full of stuff. So they would rather not leave their stuff. I mean, it's a catch-22. So what I've been doing is looking for storage space for them to put their stuff. Because like the mayor, I want them sheltered too, you know. So if getting them to the shelter means also finding a place to help them store their stuff, then that's what I focus on.
Is that something that is maybe being discussed in the city, Mayor Keller?
It is, and I know some of our partners at HopeWorks, for example, have some storage space, and I think what Khadija brings up is really the challenge of this being a citywide problem. So, you can get some shelter space in a couple of places near downtown, but it's very limited up in other parts of town. And so this is a real trade-off. I mean, it's absolutely a challenge. I think it just shows too that we've got to have this concept of the gateway center. And this is something that I've been talking about in the voters' past. And, you know, no neighborhood wants this in their neighborhood. I understand that. But Corona and every winter, we all realize that what we also need is a clearinghouse, a place where folks can go. And then it's like, okay, you need storage, then we're going to get you storage here. You need shelter, we're going to go here. You need a voucher, you're going to go here. And until we set up that place, there is literally nowhere to go for somebody on like a Saturday afternoon other than the West Side Shelter, because a lot of the other organizations aren't open on weekends or sometimes at late night. Mm-hmm. So until we have that 24/7 gateway, we're going to have this problem. And you'll hear me, I will keep pushing for this and keep asking for this, because our homeless challenges are not going to be noticeably better until we step up and build that 24/7 center so that we can get folks to the right nonprofit, the right organization that can match their needs.
Now, that's the centralized shelter and service center that I believe the city now has $14 million for. And there have been discussions going on about that for nearly a year. Where do things stand? What's kind of holding things up?
Yeah, and just to be clear, the concept of centralizing it is that just means like it's a consolidated gateway to other services. It doesn't have to be centralized geographically. It also could be, there could be multiple gateway centers. But the point is, there's got to be some places where you can get help 24/7. So where we're at, of course, you know, it was disclosed and shared. Our UNM said they did not want it on any of their lands. And that was our preferred location. So that was a major setback.
Right.
And so our study did show that there's other locations that we could do it on. And right now, actually, we formed this coordinating council that has county commissioners and city councilors and UNM on it. It is a public meeting. It meets every 2 weeks on Tuesday morning. And you can get an update there every time on the last meeting. What we looked at is we are looking at the old Loveless out on Gibson as possibly an initial location for these kinds of services. And that committee is now operating, you know, as a government body. So there's minutes people can look up, you can tune in, and so we hope actually to identify, you know, the next series of locations by the end of the year that we want to do it on. But ultimately, city council's got to vote on it,
right.
and also somebody has to be willing to have it on their property. Mm-hmm. And what happened before is no one wanted it there, but we've got to do this for our city.
Okay, I have a call from Ellen in Albuquerque. Good morning, Ellen. What is your question today?
Yeah, good morning. I'm just curious about something. I know, I realize that this is part of partly a health question, but it's also a city question. Say somebody uses Sunvan and they needed to, you know, they were out at a public place, like say grocery store or whatever, and they ended up being they got a test and they were positive. Now, the only way that the person could get home is with Sunvan.
Right.
Is there provisions where they would have, because I know that they would have to be sheltered,
right.
I mean, isolated.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, is that a big concern? Have you ever run into that problem, Mayor Keller, or, you know, whatever? And by the way, I still remember seeing you at ATC.
Well, thank you so much for your question, Ellen. So, yeah, Mayor Keller, what about what are some services for people who have tested positive and are supposed to isolate, but what if they need transportation or food or something like that? Are there any services along those lines?
Yeah, and Ellen, great to hear from you. It's a very thoughtful question, and it does point to, you know, our city had some decisions to make around, do we keep essential services open like transit, like Sunvan and like the buses, you know, or do we close them because of the situation that you outlined? And so we felt that it was important as part of the safety net to keep Sunvans and the buses open. So here's what they do. Sunvan will screen patients or passengers, and they also typically now are in a very, very reduced capacity load. So in the Sunvan, too, they have a full sanitization regimen. And so basically the idea looks like this, and then they do contact tracing. So if an individual did test positive and they were in a Sunvan, the way it should really work is that by the time another passenger has to use that same Sunvan, both the driver has been checked and changed, and the Sunvan has been fully sanitized and deep cleaned. And the patient has been contacted, and because we know where they're going, we can contact other folks. Like if they went to the grocery store, we would contact that grocery store. Now, after that point, it's really the Department of Health who runs, you know, the contact tracing and notification and so forth. But so far, knock on wood, and we expect a couple of you know, COVID-related issues in our bus system. So far, we haven't had anything major come up.
Okay, thank you. And now, Mayor Keller, I know your time is limited. Do you have time for one more question from a caller?
Sure.
Okay, we have Teresa in Albuquerque. Good morning, Teresa. What is your question?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mayor, I really appreciate everything you're doing to help people get through this pandemic. I've heard you talk about how Albuquerque is faring compared to other cities, and I'm just wondering what measures you're looking at when you say that.
Thank you.
Sure.
Teresa.
You know, that's something we actually don't hear a lot about. And it's a really important question, because I am glad I live in Albuquerque. And I think actually in many ways we should be grateful, because other cities are in a much, much worse place. So not to wish ill on Phoenix or Denver or anything else, but if you look at the positivity rates, or the, in particular, the cases per 100,000, so this is a per capita measure, you know, cities like Salt Lake, Phoenix, they are twice as bad as us. And if you look even at available beds and time to testing, Albuquerque is doing much, much better. I mean, in huge order of magnitudes, like 50% better, a full 100% better than a lot of the cities around us, even Oklahoma City, Austin. And so we literally right now are a healthier place to be during COVID. And I know we have our challenges, and this is something that, you know, we're going to continue to have to deal with. But I also know that I'm glad we live here, and I believe in our community, and I think we're demonstrating some resilience, at least compared to our peers, that actually is very extraordinary.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Mayor Keller, for coming out to the show today. We really appreciate you taking this moment to speak to us.
Thank you. Take care, and stay safe and warm and healthy.
Bye-bye. You too. Now, Khadija, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the emergency drive that you held this week, which distributed clothes and other winter necessities for unhoused folks. Do you have any plans for further activities along these lines? And if so, how can folks help out?
Yes, we do. But I would like to go back to the question the young lady asked.
Certainly.
About the person in the Sunvan.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We have a program called ABQ Mutual Aid.
Mm-hmm.
And their original conception was to provide food and necessities to those who need to quarantine. And that program is still strong and going very well, and they service all over Bernalillo County. So to those who are tested positive, or the seniors that just don't want to get out, then to contact ABQ Mutual Aid, because that group of people have truly been spot on. I've collaborated with them on several families.
Now, they've been doing impromptu drives just like yours. They've been taking care of a huge amount of people. What lessons do you think government bodies could learn from community organizers like Mutual Aid in this time of crisis?
I think that we all can learn, because they came together to deal with COVID-19. When the pandemic came and we knew that people were needing to quarantine, but they still needed food and toiletries, et cetera, this group of people came together and just went full-fledged.
Well,
I think I took a picture out of a page out of their book, because mm-hmm. when my friend posted on Facebook about the storm coming, what do we do for the unsheltered? Mm-hmm. Then I called another friend and she called a friend. So four of us got together and we had our drive-by Sunday.
So how can people get involved with something like this that's so community-driven?
Well, there are several organizations. We have Faith Work, and we have God's Warehouse, which is the largest, I call it a soup kitchen. Mm-hmm. But on a daily basis, you got 200 or 300 people at their location.
And is that something people can find online, or how can they reach out?
We're not listed online as mm-hmm. agencies that help unsheltered folks. It's just you can contact God's Warehouse. Mm-hmm. It's located on Central in Tennessee. Faith Work is located on Girard and Lomas. And everybody do have Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so there are Facebook pages for these places. Mm-hmm. And then you have a website as well, correct?
Yes, I do.
And that's, how can people find that?
www.myvisionvizionz.org.
Okay. Well, she is Khadija Bottom, Director of Visions Sankofa. Thank you so much for being on the show this morning. Have a great day. Stay warm and healthy.
Thank you for having me.
Now, our phone lines are open. What kinds of pandemic response do you want to see from candidates you're supporting this election? What lessons should decision makers have learned from the past 7 months? We'd love to hear from you. Call us now at 277-5866. And now for some more election information from KUNM's Hannah Colton.
A new survey is showing that many voters, especially people of color, are concerned about violence, militias, and police if they go to cast a ballot in person. So it's crucial to know that your vote is protected. By law, no one is allowed to threaten, harass, or intimidate you at the polls. Law enforcement officers are not supposed to be around unless it's to vote or if they're responding to a call about a public safety concern. And people who aren't police can't go to the polls dressed like law enforcement either. Anyone who tries to deprive someone of their right to vote faces up to 10 years in prison. Any election official who discriminates against a voter faces a $5,000 fine or up to 5 years prison time. If anyone messes with you or treats you unfairly, call the Voter Protection Hotline at 866-OUR-VOTE.
Now, for months, many workers have faced the impossible decision between protecting their families from the virus and continuing to bring in a paycheck. Does it have to be this way? What sorts of help do you want to see in terms of government assistance with basics like food and rent? You can give us a call at 277-5866, or you can email us at letstalk@kunm.org, or even use the Twitter hashtag letstalknm. You are listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. We'll be back in a moment.
Confrontations, property damage, and intimidation have marked the efforts by Indigenous lobster fishermen to exercise their treaty fishing rights in Nova Scotia. Government officials are working to find a solution. We'll get an update on what's happening on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
If KUNM strikes a special chord with you, donate that old A chord to keep the tunes coming. Turn your Beatle into the Beatles. Turn your Altima into the ultimate in great music. Have a Buick Century from the last century, donate it to us in this century. We accept just about anything with wheels and an engine. To find out if your car qualifies, call 888-KUNM-CAR. It just takes a few minutes. That's 888-KUNM-CAR or 888-586-6227.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. We are taking your calls on how you think our elected leaders are handling this crisis and what you want to see from politicians as we enter the seventh month of the pandemic. Join the conversation by calling 277-5866. Now, we invited Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham to join us today, but she was unavailable. However, I did record a conversation with her press secretary, Nora Myers-Sackett, yesterday about what the next several months of COVID might look like for New Mexicans. Let's hear a few minutes of that. Thank you, Nora, for joining me this morning.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So in her press conference last week, Governor Lujan Grisham said that we are trying to learn to live with the virus during what's coming, which is even tougher winter months. What does that mean?
Right now, learning to live with the virus really means that we all have to recommit to the mindset that we had, frankly, in March and April when COVID-19 was first hitting New Mexico and the rest of the country, staying home, doing our best to take no unnecessary risks to protect ourselves and our fellow New Mexicans, while we are also doing our best not to, quote unquote, shut down our economy.
If these numbers keep increasing, are we likely to see the kind of health order that shuts down all non-essential businesses like we saw back in April?
So we have all the tools that we need at our disposal already, and they're the same tools that we had in March and April, except that we know even more about the effectiveness of masks and not interacting with others. And we are operating in this reality created by the president and congressional Republicans who have not furthered aid to the states. And we are the United States. We are not the country of New Mexico. And we depend on the federal government to do their part. And they haven't been. We need rent relief for New Mexicans. We need restaurants. And bar relief, bars haven't been able to open, and those businesses, you know, are the backbones of our community, and they're waiting on their relief that they deserve. We need additional unemployment help, and New Mexico is using every tool in the toolbox to assist New Mexicans, but we are operating in a vacuum of federal assistance, and it's creating an unfortunate reality.
So the state's land grant permanent fund currently contains $19.7 billion, I believe. This is often referred to as a rainy day fund for use during times of need. Are there any plans to use that fund as we enter this next phase of the crisis?
So any kind of action like that would have to stem from the legislature. The governor cannot take that kind of action on her own. The governor is absolutely, she wants to pursue every possible avenue for getting additional aid to New Mexicans. We're not going to rule anything out. We're going to work with anyone who is open to such opportunities as well.
Now, the state does have about $13 million in housing assistance for people who are behind on their rent or mortgage payments. Myers-Sackett said applications will be open next week, and you can learn more at nmhousing.org. There's also aid available for business owners and nonprofits. We've got links to these resources on the show page. Now, we also wanted to speak to COVID-related policy at the national level, like that second coronavirus relief package that Congress failed to pass this week. We reached out to both U.S. Senators Martin Heinrich and Tom Udall, but they were unable to join us today. So instead, let's take a more global look at COVID responses. While record outbreaks are flaring up across the U.S., there are many other countries where new cases have flatlined and where death rates over the course of the pandemic have been magnitudes lower than ours. At this point, I'd like to welcome Professor Gary Prevost, Professor of Political Science with the College of St. Benedict and St. John's University in Minnesota, and the author of several books on Latin American and U.S.-Cuban relations. Thank you for joining us, Professor Prevost.
Hello.
Good morning. Okay, I think we just lost Professor Prevost. So instead, we're going to take a look at New Zealand, which as of October 20th, this nation of 5 million has not had a single positive case in a 10-day period. Professor John Etzel is a former instructor at the University of New Mexico who now teaches management communication at the University of Waikato in New Zealand. Right now, it's just before 4 a.m. there. So we recorded a conversation with Professor Etzel earlier this week about New Zealand's approach to COVID-19.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us today, John.
First of all, what is day-to-day life like in Hamilton, New Zealand right now? Are there currently any restrictions in place?
No restrictions whatsoever.
None at all.
There's no cases in our region at all. Day-to-day life is normal, what used to be normal before the COVID pandemic. We do have people in what we call managed isolation, which is when you, if you travel into New Zealand, and the only people who can travel are actually New Zealand citizens or special permits, you have to quarantine for 14 days at a hotel, and you test on two different days, day 3 and day 12. And then if you test positive, you move to a different hotel that is for COVID positive people only.
So can you kind of walk me through New Zealand's public health restrictions since March? What sort of measures did the government take when this first started happening, and how did that progress?
Early March, there were 3, 4, 5 cases here every once in a while. So about the same time the U.S. went into lockdown, we went into lockdown. But our lockdown was very restrictive. They closed everything that they didn't call an essential service. And those essential services were grocery stores, hospitals, petrol stations, gas stations. And then certainly anything in the food supply was open, but no restaurants were open. We couldn't even do takeaway food. We were expected to stay in our bubble in our home, and we did that for about 5 weeks. That was called level 4. Level 3 is a smaller restrictions where we opened up restaurants for takeaways. And we did that for about 3 weeks, and almost there were no new cases in the community. And so we went down to level 2, which opened up gyms. You could have no gatherings of more than 100 people. Restaurants were at 25 or 50% capacity. Mm-hmm. And then right now we're in level 1. And level 1 means we have border restrictions.
So in the U.S., early, I think it was in April, Americans received a check for $1,200 from the federal government. A second round of stimulus just failed in Congress on Monday. What sort of financial support did New Zealand's government offer to its citizenry?
Yeah, New Zealand offered a similar stimulus package. It wasn't a check to everyone. It was wage subsidy for people who lost their jobs or for employers who then were able to keep employees on the payroll. So restaurants that were locked down, they got a wage subsidy. And so then they could pay people to stay employed.
How long did that last?
It's lasted for, I want to say it was 6 months. I know they ended relatively recently. Although there's still some talk about ongoing, so long as, I mean, our economy like the U.S. restricted, but we didn't restrict that much. And a part of it is that we're free and open. We miss the tourism, of course, from overseas, but we're able to travel freely within New Zealand. So that's made it a lot easier. So that's been their strategy, is to get businesses back open. If we have no COVID, then things can operate normally.
So I assume you've been following what's been going on here in the U.S. and in New Mexico. What do you think the biggest differences have been in how the governments here and in New Zealand have approached the crisis?
Number one is we've had a very strong, clear leadership from our prime minister. She's practices a compassionate, empathetic leadership style that fits very well in crisis. The U.S. lacks really a clear plan for how to manage this. You get contradictory messages where what she's doing is listening to the public health experts here. So we have some advantages that the U.S. does not have relative. One is that we're an island nation, so it's easy to control movements, relatively easy. We also have a lot of trust in government as a country, not everybody, but overall there's faith in following what's been done. So this is what we're told to do, so we do it. And so that compliance has helped a lot. Mostly we've had clear messaging. There's never been any inconsistency. You know, there's been clarity about exactly what we're expected to do, what's required. And that's not to say everybody's been thrilled with it. You know, it's created a lot of challenges, but in the end, we knew exactly what was expected and what to do. And when there was misunderstandings, they got corrected quickly. Whereas in the U.S., there's still a lack of consistent message.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. And I hope for all the best for you and that things stay great in New Zealand.
Thank you. Yeah, I hope so, too. It can change very quickly.
True enough.
Now, that was John Etzel, a former UNM professor who now lives in New Zealand. Are you a person who lives in New Mexico that originally came from a different country that has some thoughts on how your country of origin has handled this crisis? Or maybe through the magic of the internet, you're listening in another country right now, this would be a great time for you to call in and tell us, what lessons do you think our elected leaders should learn from other countries that avoided high death tolls? Or conversely, what mistakes have those other countries made that we should avoid? Give us a call at 277-5866, or you can email us at letstalk@kunm.org. And you can use the Twitter hashtag Let's Talk NM and tweet your thoughts to us. Now, we have tried to get a hold of a Professor Gary Prevost again. Unfortunately, it looks like that might not work out this morning. So instead, I'm going to be speaking to Hannah Colton, our news director. Hannah, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Good morning. Yes, I can indeed.
So I wanted to bring in a little bit more election info, but I know you had a really interesting conversation with
Professor Prevost.
With Professor Prevost this week. Are there any, I know you're not the expert on Cuba, but right, are there any sort of takeaways that that he shared about their approach and how they avoided so many cases and so many deaths there?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, certainly Cuba's a very different country from the U.S., but just to give you, our listeners, an idea of how successful Cuba's approach was, they have a population of 11.3 million people, and they had 6,678 total cases of COVID and 128 deaths. Now, here in New Mexico, we have about 2 million people, which is 1/6 the population. But we've had 7 times the number of cases and 9 times the number of deaths. And if we look at the U.S. as a whole, Americans are about 42 times more likely to contract the virus than Cubans.
Wow.
And I think my takeaway from speaking to Professor Prevost was that a lot of it has to do with the way that that Cuba does healthcare. Having a single-payer system allowed them to mobilize much more effectively than the kind of piecemeal privatized system that we have here in the U.S.
And that has everything to do with the socialized form of government, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it certainly, you know, there are people who would argue pros and cons about that form of government. But when it came to healthcare and the need to actually like take care of these millions of people, some of whom live in very rural situations, it worked very well.
So how, like, what are some of the details of that? Are people able to get sort of needed services for free?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's absolutely for free in Cuba. So they are able to receive the care that they need at any time. And during, you know, COVID-19, they were able to receive testing and treatment without having to worry about the cost, which is something that we see in the United States. A lot of people might be concerned about going to their local testing center if they're not sure if their insurance is going to cover it, or if they have COVID, then that opens up a whole new door of price issues, cost issues.
Right. And especially, I mean, so many people's health insurance is tied to their jobs. So with so many people losing their jobs, it's just been a nightmare.
Exactly. And, you know, that is something that that has really kind of hampered the U.S. response, apparently, according to Professor Prevost. So tell me a little bit about the kind of election coverage that we can expect in the next week or so. I mean, Election Day is right around the corner, but we do expect this to kind of stretch on beyond that, don't we?
Yeah. This is going to be an Election Day unlike one we've covered. You know, normally it's for reporters, it's a big push on Election Day. You know, we stay up all night, you know, putting the results together, getting stories ready for morning, doing some analysis of those results, but we're, you know, everything we're hearing is that there's so many mailed-in ballots this year that we may not have any of those results on election night proper. So
yes,
it might be, and you know, we usually have to wait till the next morning for official results, but
right,
instead of just waiting till the next morning, it might be, you know, days or even weeks before we have official results in a lot of these races. And then, of course, we've heard from President Trump, you know, he's refused to say outright that he'll accept the results of the election if he loses. He's also called on, you know, armies of poll watchers using this militaristic language. So there's a lot of a lot of concerns about what might happen in the days following the election, and it's something that we'll just have to stay on our toes to be watching out for.
Now, you mentioned in one of your recorded pieces that there is some concerns about voter intimidation at the polls, and we've had we've had early voting locations open already for a while now. Has there been any reports of voter intimidation at this point?
You know, I haven't heard anything except for reports of Trump supporters showing up to polls. I think it was last weekend.
Uh-huh.
I'm losing track of time. But that's definitely something we're going to be hearing from the Secretary of State coming up in just about 6 minutes. They're doing a live briefing, and we're going to be asking them about that. And we'll be checking in with Common Cause and the ACLU, who have that voter protection hotline, on election day for sure, mm-hmm. to find out if what they're hearing. I did, you know, before we run out of time here, I had one other piece of sort of logistics to offer folks. So I wanted to remind people that, you know, state officials say that now at this point, 5 days until the election day, it's too late to rely on the Postal Service to deliver your ballot in time. So mail-in voting effectively over, but you can still take your absentee ballot to any polling station through Saturday or on election day. And, you know, if you go to a polling station with that absentee ballot, a poll worker will get you right to the front of the line. That's what the county clerk told us, and get you right in and out to drop that off. There are also, there's a whole list at nmvote.org in other counties. There are, you know, not only those indoor drop boxes at the polls, but there's also walk up or drive up drop boxes in some places. So we'll post that link where you can find that information. And then, you know, if you aren't going to go to the polls yourself, you can also have an immediate family member or a caregiver deliver your absentee ballot for you. So if you look on the envelope, there's a place for the delivery person to sign and sort of certify, like, I am this person's mother or aunt, or I guess not aunt, it's immediate family.
You can't, no caregiver. Aunts allowed.
No aunts allowed. That's, you know, it's too bad.
Right. But the main takeaway there sounds like do not mail at this point.
Do not mail.
Show up in person.
Yeah. And the last little bit, if you did request or get your absentee ballot but changed your mind or, you know, messed up the ballot, whatever, you can still go and decide you want to vote in person. So you, a poll worker will get your signature. They can cancel out your old ballot and issue a new one on the spot.
Well, that is all the time that we have today. Thanks to everyone who called in to share your thoughts. Thanks so much to our guests, Albuquerque Mayor Tim Keller, Khadija Asili Bottom, Nora Meyer-Sackett, Professor John Etzel, and we did try with Dr. Gary Prevost, and it just didn't work out, but thank you so much for being available to us, and thank you to Hannah Colton. The conversation does not have to end here. Share your thoughts on Twitter, #LetsTalkNM on Facebook. #LetsTalkNM. On Facebook, you can search for KUNM Radio, or you can email letstalk@kunm.org. If you missed part of the show, you can stream it online or subscribe to Let's Talk New Mexico on any podcast platform. Now, up next on the KUNM2 online stream, we are going to carry live coverage of an election briefing by Secretary of State Maggie Toulouse-Oliver. She will discuss what voters can expect on Tuesday and the crucial following days here in New Mexico. That starts in a few minutes. Tune in at kunm.org. Hit that drop-down arrow at the top right and click on KUNM2. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Kaveh Movahed screened your calls. Taylor Velasquez live tweeted the show today, and Hannah Colton is our executive producer. I'm Ty Bannerman. Thank you for listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.